Okay, let me call the meeting to order. I'm Bill Taylor. I'm Council Judiciary Committee and staff for this work group. Unfortunately, the enabling statute did not appoint a chair. It did appoint members. So to get the process rolling, that's what I'm doing. First item on the agenda is to have people identify themselves. Nancy, why don't we start with you?
Nancy Cozine, Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services and prior practitioner of juvenile dependency and delinquency, representation of children and parents.
Megan Schultz, Executive Director of CASA of Lane County and current chair of the Oregon CASA Network.
Lynnae Garrett, Director of CASA in Lynn County.
Patricia Sullivan, Circuit Court Judge, Malheur County.
Leola McKenzie, Juvenile Court Programs Director for the State Court Administrator's Office.
Valerie Love, Juvenile Court Judge, Lane County Circuit Court.
Lori Fellows, Senior Deputy District Attorney in Multnomah County. I run our Juvenile Justice Division. I'm here for the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
Angela Sherbo, Supervising Attorney at Youth Rights and Justice and an appointee of the Oregon State Bar. I represent children and parents in trial and appellate courts.
And Joanne Southey at DOJ. I'm the Deputy Chief Counsel for the Civil Enforcement Division and also acting attorney in charge of all the child advocacy section AAGs across the state. So there's about 50 of us that do the work and represent DHS child welfare.
And Michael, do you want to introduce yourself?
Mike Riley, Judiciary Office Coordinator and staff at Bill.
He's really the guy that runs this process. next order of business is adoption of work group rules. You have a copy in front of you. Do you have a motion to
adopt? I'll move to adopt the rules.
I second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Hearing no nays? Did you raise your hand?
Yep.
Okay. The rules are adopted. Next order of business is election of chair or chairperson. So the temporary chair will entertain motions for someone to be chairperson.
I would like to recommend Judge Sullivan as our chair.
Second?
I second.
Any other nominations? Consider the nominations closed.
Okay.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Judge, you are now in charge.
All right. Thank you. Okay. And so we've done the organizational things. And the next thing we need to do is move to the information. And the first person on the agenda is Michael Livingston and Megan Schultz on the history of House Bill 3363 and the intent of the work group. So I'll yield the floor to you.
I brought
Well, my name's Megan Schultz. I already introduced myself. As a disclaimer, I am not an attorney and I am not a social worker. I like to think of myself as a change maker. I am and also a small business manager in the business of engaging communities to address this issue of child abuse and neglect. And I've been the CASA director in Lane County for 14 years, and I was a CASA volunteer for 6 years. I'm currently the chair of the Oregon CASA Network. But prior to that, in 2011, I was the legislative chair for the Oregon CASA Network, which is how we ended up here today. In 2012, I had been coordinating 160 legislative advocate volunteers from around the state of Oregon. And I went around the state in the summer of 2012 with some other people from my legislative committee to talk about what causes we're seeing on the ground, what were things that they were frustrated with about the system in general. You can imagine when you ask that question to a room full of volunteers over and over and over again across the state, I just took copious notes because CASA volunteers are very passionate and dedicated to this cause. And so I just listened and I wrote and didn't ask a lot of questions. When I got back from that tour, I was looking through all this information that I had, and it was obvious that some of the frustrations or things that the CASAs were seeing on the ground were really local things. They were issues that needed to be resolved with their local DHS branch or their local jurisdiction or service providers in their local communities. So I just gave that information back to those CASA directors from those counties. Some of the things were things that the OCN, the Oregon CASA Network, could address on a statewide level by just talking to our partners. And there was a couple things that I just needed more information about in order to really understand what was the problem they were trying to bring forward. One of those question mark issues was psychotropic meds. So all around the state, on the ground, CASAs were frustrated with the use of psychotropic meds. But I wasn't asking questions, so I didn't have enough information to go back and say, here's what I think the issue is. This is why they seem like they're frustrated. So that's an example of one of the things that just got left on the table. And then we brought forward there were these issues that really were about delays in the system. And, you know, CASAs are appointed to the most difficult cases that we have. We don't get appointed to easy cases. And so we're really seeing the extreme end of things, not the average end of things. We don't get appointed to the cases where the court feels like, you know, in a couple months, these kids can go home if there's enough, you know, the right services provided and the parents engaged. So we're not appointed to those cases. We're appointed to the cases where the kids have been in the system a long time or things are just stuck. And those are the cases that we get appointed to. So these delays that they're seeing are coming from that lens, the lens of the most difficult cases. What I have in front of you was the original potpourri of House Bill 3363, not in its entirety. And Michael's looking at me like, what? So that we took having not being new to the legislative process, we ended up choosing to put all of the issues into one bill. That's why you see so many in different kind of all over the map. The first one was, and I'm not going to go through all the issues, but the first one is one that got resolved in the House Bill 3363, which was CASA programs and CASAs having access to all information about from the parents and the children, not just the children. So access to all information. That one was resolved in the House bill. The other issues brought Michael, Judge Livingston, and I together. And I have to say that Angela Sherbo also had many conversations with me because, as I mentioned before, I'm not an attorney. I'm just bringing forward the concerns and trying to and get them addressed. So through all these conversations, what ended up happening to the House bill is that we agreed that the issue of the records on everybody would all agree that we could move that through in the House bill, and that many of these other things, such as the second petitions, so CASAs were saying, hey, we get all the way to the permanency hearing, and then all of a sudden, one of the attorneys or DHS says, we can't go to permanency yet because this parent's issue of, domestic violence was not on the original petition, and we really need to address that issue and provide services before we can go to permanency. So what we were seeing was, right before a permanency hearing, or it felt like right before a permanency hearing, we stop dead in our tracks and we have to go back and file a new petition and start the clock over again. And so CASAs were saying, can't we try and get those issues up on, early on in the case, early in the petition or early in the process? So those were the, as you can read, the types of issues that that we were trying to address. So we ended up at the end of the day agreeing to bring forth in the House bill the information about the discovery and also this idea of a work group. So this is my interpretation, and Michael will probably say it different, but at the end of the day, Michael convinced me that it wasn't the statutes that needed to be changed, that the statutes really did what we needed them to do. It was the practice on the ground that needed to change. That, again, my interpretation. So I said, great, if it's the practice on the ground that needs to change, then what are we going to do about it? How can we pull together a group of people that represent, you know, all the faces, stakeholders in this process of dependency? How can we pull together voices from all those stakeholder groups, people that are going to think outside the box, that are not going to be protecting their turf? We need people that we're going to come to the table and really talk about what are the issues and have permission to talk about what are the issues and the courage to talk about what are the issues so that we can stop the delays and that we can get kids home as quickly and as safely as possible. So that's why you're sitting here today, is because we believe that you are those people. We believe that you are the out-of-the-box thinkers, that you have a wealth of knowledge that will help us resolve the delays, or one, identify the delays and then resolve the delays. And I have to mention that the only thing that we did go to the table again in front of the legislature that we didn't agree upon was CASA still brought forth this idea of that while all children deserve to get out as quickly and safely as possible, it is imperative that that age group of 0 to 3, all that we know about early brain development and bonding and attachment, CASA still feels strongly that those kids have a higher priority, if you want to put a priority on any child, which we don't. But we want to make sure that those kids get moved through quicker. And one of the things that we were asking for in the bill was that there were more frequent court hearings in order to do that, believing that when you have to get in front of a judge and explain why we haven't moved on this case or why a parent hasn't accessed services or been offered services, that it's a little bit, puts fire under people's feet to move when you have to get in front of a judge and explain why things aren't moving. So in the end, that did not move out of, was not passed through in the legislature. And what was passed through was this, again, back to discovery and the reason why we have this house, why you guys are sitting here today. I think, yeah, so now you can, like, say your side of the story.
They're not two sides. What we found as we worked through parts of the bill were two things. One, that the problems that these parts of the bill that are no longer in the bill were designed to address were real, but the changes in the law that were proposed to reach them, not number one, didn't solve the problem, and in many respects created other problems. But that didn't mean that the problems that were real and had been identified shouldn't be addressed. And as we work through this, well, what do we do? You know, how do we approach this? We started thinking about the model court team model that some juvenile court systems have, and that's where the juvenile court judge, the DHS representative, the DA, the local defense consortium meet together to work a problem. And I'll give you just a very simple example. In Benton County, they became aware that their time to jurisdiction was not good based on the data that they had. And so they formed a model court team, and in the formation of that court team, they decided to address that problem. It's the kind of problem that Justice Brewer, who works very diligently labors in the fields of juvenile law, calls the low-hanging fruit, and that's not to discount the significance of it, but it sort of identifies that this is an obvious thing that we can all agree on. And within about 15 minutes, everybody at that table owned a part of that problem and figured out what they were going to do to solve it. And it was a very simple solution. About 10 minutes into the discussion, somebody said, we have to have settlement conferences that are meaningful because nobody's coming to them to settle them. And what the, once that sort of dam broke in terms of the thinking, then they started working the problem about how to get that into action. And one thing, for example, they had to do was to work with the other two judges so that the attorneys who were going to be at the settlement conference didn't have a conflicting schedule in another court. Just an example of getting together. And what that was, when they left the table, it was kind of a contract in a way with each other. We're going to, you know, we all own this problem, and here's what we're going to do to fix it, and then we're going to measure whether this has had any impact. Now, it's kind of a daunting thing to take that local model and put it at the state level. But so many of the problems that had been identified by Megan, and we identified other ones as we worked this bill, really were the same kind of problem. And it's really gratifying, frankly, to see that the entities that are represented here are serious enough about this undertaking to bring people, to appoint people who are really going to work the problem. So that's the paradigm. In a nutshell, is to work the problem. And I'll talk about it in a minute. I have a very brief PowerPoint to kind of go through the bill. The deliverable, if you will, that this group has is a little bit different from the deliverable that a lot of other work groups have. You know, it's not to bring back to the legislature some findings. And it's not to bring back to the legislature, at least the first priority, is not to bring back to the legislature recommendations for changes in the law. Although you may do that, the first priority really is to identify the problems that you can identify, and then speaking on behalf and working on behalf of the entities that you represent to work that problem and come up with a way to address it statewide in as concrete and specific a term as you can. And the good news is, I think, that many of these are sort of low-hanging fruit, and the solutions to many of them, I think, lie in parts of the juvenile code that often get overlooked. You know, many times it's a question of simply asking the right question at the right stage of a proceeding. So this is again, it's a daunting enterprise, and we get to the what it is that you're supposed to look at and identify. It sounds like describe the universe and give two examples, but it really isn't. And I don't think the charge of the group is to do this sort of comprehensive encyclopedic type inquiry into the code. It really is to come up with a plan that's going to work, and also be within the capacity of each entity to carry out. We don't want to say we're going to try to do this. We're going to say we're going to do this, and that's the charge, I think, of the group. If I can, on just a personal note, I was really pleased to see that Judge Sullivan is on this group, because she's been attacking these sorts of problems in her county for years.
I've been
because
outside
of
the
distance
block for a long time.
Yeah. and of necessity, because of the distances in her county and the paucity relative paucity of services. So it's a good fit. So I hope you'll bear with me as I go through this. The first thing I want to talk about is what the work group shall do. And this is the describe the universe and give two examples piece. And what this part is intended to do is to capture in broad terms the categories of problems that came up as we talked about what Megan had found. The first one, you can read them yourself. The first one, for example, is a timely resolution. The second one, assessment of the basis for dependency jurisdiction, that really is one of the specific problems that Megan's survey brought to mind. And if you remember, there was a case in the Oregon Court of Appeals, JS, I think it was, that said, at a permanency hearing, when you are looking at the progress of the parents and you're looking at the sufficiency of the DHS efforts, that's with respect to the basis for jurisdiction. And even though the statute that covers DHS case plan says the case plan has to be related to the basis for jurisdiction, over the years things got off track. And often during the course of a case, there would be understandable requirements put on the parent that really didn't have anything to do with the basis for jurisdiction. So in response to that case, some of the things that Megan just described happened. There was kind of a scramble close to the time of the permanency hearing to make sure that the jurisdictional basis really reflected what was going on in the case, and that meant pushing the case out even further. But even though that particular case, that particular issue has largely been addressed, there's still times, a number of times in cases where the jurisdiction basis really should change because the case has changed or you find out different information. I don't want to go too deeply into that, but that's sort of what that's about. Then after you identify these impediments, and again, I would urge you, even though the term low-hanging fruit does not appear in the bill, to keep that sort of thing in mind. The very first thing you do after you've done that is to identify the specific actions each entity represented by the work group can take under existing law within current budgetary restraints to remove and mitigate these impediments, and to develop a plan to put those actions into practice and to measure the effectiveness of those actions. That's the contract. That's the primary deliverable. And there are two other sort of deliverables, but they're in the statute in this order for a specific reason, and that is this is the first. And this sounds a little bit presumptuous, but I don't mean it to be. I would recommend that you not discuss while you're doing this part the legislative part, because I think mixing those things up is tempting and easy thing to do. I think it would be appropriate, and this does sound presumptuous, anyway, I think it would be appropriate as these things come up, if there's a legislative idea that comes to mind, to make note of it. But this is really the hard work right here, in many ways the most meaningful. So And that was certainly the intent of the legislature. If you look at the history and the testimony, the representations to the judiciary committees, both in the House and the Senate, were this is the heart of it, and this, in effect, is a contract among the entities that are represented. And that plan is not just to be on a shelf, it's to be implemented. So this is sort of the heart of it. And then in this capacity, remembering that everybody owns a piece of the problem, the roles are different, but the goal is the same, which is what it is that you decide you need to do to address it. And then second, to identify the changes in existing law that would be made to assist in removing those that don't cost any more money. I mean, that would be a nice package, for example, as a pragmatic consideration to come back to the legislature with. We can do these under existing law without any changes in law or anything else, and we're committed to do it and work that problem. And if we had these other things, we could remove some more. And then finally, the changes to existing law that would mitigate but require more funds. And that really is the sequence of decision making and deliverable that was intended by the statute. If I could go through and just give some examples, both of problems and solutions. This is not to suggest that you identify these, but just some examples at each stage of the juvenile dependency proceeding. At the shelter hearing, appointment of counsel. There are many counties in the state where the appointment of counsel does not occur until after the shelter hearing. Two counties that I know of are Linn County and Columbia County. In Columbia County, it can be as long as 30 days before the parent has an attorney or meets with an attorney. That a simple change in that practice, and again, it's not in every county, not only addresses the time to jurisdiction problem, but I think has the effect in many cases of changing the tone of the case, of getting the jurisdictional petition to actually reflect what's going on in the proceeding, and in many cases to avoid the necessity of substitute care, either initially or over the long term. Something I know that the Chief Justice is interested in seeing if this can happen and what he can do to encourage it. There are models for transformation that have already taken place in Marion County. The consortium did that. I don't want to go too far with this, but that would be a very simple change that would have a lot of impact. The jurisdictional hearing. everyone's aware of the standard of current risk of harm. This would be an area to keep, to keep in mind, you know, to make sure that the that whether it's an admission or an adjudication, a trial, that this is the focus, and then to work toward that, resolving that, and then to keep the bases for jurisdiction always in mind. So if they change, if there's no current risk of harm but there is over there, that some adjudication is made early. And I think maybe that there's probably more here at the dispositional hearing and the case planning than anywhere else, and I think this is part that's overlooked. If you look at this is 419B343, the case plan has to be rationally related to the basis for jurisdiction. Bill, what have I done?
I saw the kayaks.
Okay. That's not a one-time assessment. You know, this goes to, you know, has the case plan really changed from the basis for jurisdiction? And so everybody's eye ought to be on that all the time, because not doing that, there's delay. The reunification plan has to have appropriate services. I don't think that means that if you have a mother or father with a drug problem, that you've referred the person to drug treatment. That doesn't make it appropriate to the individual needs, to the extent it can be made. For example, low cognitive ability, same thing with parent training or anything else. The most overlooked part is within a reasonable time, and that's a term of art. It's not related to reasonable time to the parent. It's related to reasonable time for the child. And the earlier in the case that sometimes difficult thing to prove or establish is established, the easier the planning is going to be. For example, let's say you have a particular set of services for a parent with drug treatment, and then you get down to the reasonable time and you say, well, that series of services is not going to get us there to the reasonable time thing. Now, it can't be a perfect fit all the time, obviously, but I don't think you work the problem until you at least ask the question. And the reasonable time piece, there's not going to be an expert out there anywhere who's going to say this child has, you know, 8 months, 9 days, and 44 minutes. It's not going to be like that. But there are some directions, thankfully, in recent cases. There's a case early last year, I think, Judge Walheim. It's called FLB. It's a termination case, but the standard is the same. The definition is the same, and it lists in pretty detail what the reasonable time is. And again, all of these are choke points for delay. All of them. And again, the earlier in the case that the reasonable time for the child is identified, the easier it gets later on. It occurs two other times in the juvenile code, once in the permanency hearing statute and the other in the termination statute, but it means the same in every case. Conditions of return. This comes from the Oregon safety model from DHS, and it's a very I think it's a very good concept. It's a workable tool, but it's hardly ever applied as a tool. It's sort of a throwaway line in an action agreement. But what it really is, it's concrete things that have to happen in the case, conditions of return that must exist before the child can be safely placed in the home. The juvenile court judges in 2012 undertook as one of their three initiatives this initiative to make these conditions of return more concrete and understandable. And I'll give you just one example. Often in action agreements or service agreements or expectations, a condition of return will be listed as successfully complete drug treatment. That may be a condition for getting the juvenile court out of it, juvenile court jurisdiction, but it's not necessarily a condition of returning the child safely home. People could be in drug treatment and still have a child safely in the home. And again, until the questions ask, you know, are there specific things that can be done, then the thinking is not there. Also, if you'll note that it's the measure is make it possible for the child to safely return home. And that's the same language that's in the permanency hearing statute. So really, reunification has two different faces. One is the more narrow face, which is put the child back in the home safely. The other is the broader one, get the juvenile court out of the case. And often we conflate the two, I think. And again, I think that causes delay. Visitation. Often visitation is the most meaningful reunification service that can be offered in a substitute care case. And unfortunately, many times it's sort of the throwaway piece of a case plan. DHS rules say that children have a right, these people have a right to visit as often as reasonably necessary to develop and enhance their attachment to each other. That's a case-by-case consideration. And that if the department resources can't meet those needs, the caseworker must solicit help from family and community resources outside, often overlooked. And when there are delays in getting into the sort of more standard treatment services, at least this bond and relationship of the child can be increased and supported. And often that may have the effect of making the longer-term service unnecessary. But I think all of these are areas where there could be elimination of delays and moving the case along, getting the parent more involved in the case. The six-month review hearing, both at CRB, whether it's in CRB or the court, is a great opportunity, I think, in what I've seen, to sort of double-check where are we in the case. And number three there, I think, would be an excellent place to avoid some delays. To be in very concrete terms, so that you'll know what has to be done and what progress has to be made, rather than the more general. So much of this is just making very specific and concrete what's already there. And again, what's the child's reasonable time? I wanted to talk for a minute about this case because it's sort of the perfect storm case that shows what happens when basically everybody is asleep at the wheel as a case goes its sort of regular course. This was a case the parents were convicted of a sex offense back in 2001 involving a minor child. The mother was diagnosed. She's low cognitive ability and some with paraphilia. The father had some substance abuse problems. But jurisdiction was, I think, in 2010 or 11. I'm not sure. So it was unrelated to the crime. It was the lack of sex offender treatment primarily. But if you look at the timeline, the jurisdiction judgment 11 months after the child was first placed in shelter care. The permanency hearing 18 months after that. And you see what the statutes require. 60 days for jurisdiction, 12 months for permanency. Record also showed that the agency's delay in getting services of a provider for the mother's sex offender treatment, the treatment itself didn't begin until 16 months after the dispositional order, so 2 months before the permanency hearing. And somewhere along that 16-month period, somebody might have noticed that this case plan was not appropriate. You see, and so we keep looking at the subject of the case plan rather than how it's actually working out in time. And finally, at the permanency hearing, because of the delay and because the mother hadn't had the benefit of those services, the juvenile court continued the reunification plan and scheduled another permanency hearing 1 year later. There's nothing in the record either that's inferred or expressed that says that the judge took into account whether that 1 year was a reasonable time for the child, even though the finding was made. There was no reference to any evidence. And it appears that what the judge did was say, well, the mother lost 12 months of opportunity to address this issue, so she gets another 12 months. At the JSIP conference, when we were talking about this case, one of the judges from this county came up and said, do you want to know what happened, how this happened? And I said, yeah. He said, well, all the judges but one, the presiding judge, had some kind of conflict. You know, like this particular judge was a district attorney while that criminal case was in the office. And I didn't say this at the time, but I was thinking, so what? I mean, the statutes are still there. And what I was wondering is, I don't mean to say that in a judgmental, blaming way, but I'm talking about what the obligations of the people involved are. And I was thinking, well, you can waive that kind of conflict. Anybody who was at DOJ, for example, had to have waivers if they went on the bench. There are judges from other counties who are available, and there's Kim Blanding in OJD who can get Plan B judges. And that initially, of course, is a judicial responsibility. But people can't sit back and say, well, the judge is not doing anything. I can't do anything. We'll just go with this. And so, again, in many ways, this case is a kind of perfect storm because everybody involved, the CASA, the parents' attorneys, the DA with the jurisdiction, DHS, and there's no question that they were beating the bushes trying to find the right person for this case, but look at the result of not examining the case planning, the appropriateness of the case planning, and having that be a functional analysis rather than a substantive one. You know, mother needs sex offender treatment, we're trying to find it. It's everybody has to wait. But this is really a sort of a big version of what can happen in small versions in other cases. And I'll conclude with this sort of small example. Two small examples. Most people have heard about or seen cases where you have the domestic violence assessment and then 48 weeks of domestic violence training. Often those programs will not accept money from anybody but the person who's being treated. And often for these folks that are involved in these cases, it's just an impossible thing to do, a dilemma. You know, and in one case that I'm familiar with, the caseworker caught that this plan wasn't working. You know, it fit what the person needed, but it wasn't working for the case and for the child. And so she said, this was in Marion County, and when I was in the court out there, she said, you know, let's take a second look at whether we need 48 weeks of DV treatment. And so she took the assessment and went out to, I think it was Marion County Mental Health, and said, do you have programs that can address this? And they did. And so that eliminated the problem. But that was somebody looking at the case and saying, well, it's appropriate on paper. It's appropriate because of the substance, but it's not working. And she worked that problem. In another case, a young woman with cognitive limitations with a very young child needed hands-on parenting, and that was the primary order in the dispositional order. 4.5 months later, at a review hearing, she was still on a waiting list for that treatment, and the court report said it would be another 90 days or so before she got any hands-on parenting. She was getting 1 hour a week of supervised visitation, and the judge in that case at the hearing said, why isn't the SSA, who's supervising the visits, sort of helping and coaching this mom until she can get on the list? And before the caseworker could answer, one of the attorneys in the room, I think it was the AG, stood up and said, well, those people aren't certified or qualified or something to do that. And that was kind of interesting to me because I thought that I saw in the caseworker sort of she was starting to work the problem too, and then that sort of cut that off. But the foster parent was in the room, and so we worked out right there in the room, or the judge did, that the foster parent was going to help during the visits to do the basic coaching that the mother need. Another example of seeing that the proposed case plan is not working and then fixing the problem. And I think that many times that same approach can apply to other impediments, but it does take consistency across the state. And I do know that, you know, back like the conditions of return and also the visitation, those policies don't get out and don't get implemented consistently across the state, and they are great policies. And I would presume to say that the agency would would be thankful for the help from other people in getting those things out there and implementing, because they're really good policies. I apologize for the length and for the rambling, but I think that this is a great opportunity to work and solve some problems and to move juvenile dependency in a great direction. And again, it's gratifying to see from the folks who are appointed here that each of the entities represented is serious about solving these problems. Thank you.
Now, I don't know if we want to entertain questions or...
I'll be happy to.
Yeah. Does anyone have any questions?
My case of two counties don't have attorneys appointed time of the shelter hearing.
There are more than that, but those are two that I know of.
Has there been any evaluation of the time frames related to that to actually demonstrate that that is an effective tool in speeding the case up?
Yeah. You sort of have to reason backwards. I mean, or look at it backwards. In Linn County, and Ms. Garrett, you probably are more familiar with this than I. Linn County separates out the jurisdiction from the disposition by quite a bit.
Okay.
And part of that is because there's a handoff between the sort of protective service worker and the permanency worker. If they had an earlier appointment, in that case, it would move back. So even if they kept that separate track, it would move back their timeline. And in Columbia County, and this is, you know, Leola really has the raw data for this. Mine is anecdotal, but I visited up there working with the judges on other issues and sat in on a number of hearings. And one of the things that it does in that case is there are continuances all the time because of the lack of discovery and the lack of preparation.
Okay.
So it does have that effect. And the appointment, I think, the timeliness to jurisdiction is only one of the benefits of that appointment. It would change the tone of the hearing. It would get the, I mean, most of parents, for example, have been in court only for criminal matters, and so that's their paradigm for what's going on in the case. And so there are other benefits of it, but Leola, you have the data on the counties. We could probably match that up with the...
We don't have it matched up currently and haven't looked at that in a while, but that is something that we can do.
And I can tell you anecdotally from having done it both ways, because we appoint in all cases before the shelter hearing starts, so nobody shows up unless they demand to be self-represented without counsel at a shelter hearing. Mm-hmm. And the difference it makes is pretty profound. In one area in particular that I think everybody needs to aware of is that the situations where you're going to work something out that involves an alternative to non-relative foster placement increases tremendously if you have counsel at the shelter care hearing.
Well, I thank you for taking on this responsibility.
Now, the next thing we have, and people have sent some emails with some materials and things too, is what the current landscape looks like and what the data tells us. And the order that we have these listed here, the first one is DHS. So, Lois, do you want to
speak to that a little bit?
Yes.
Okay. I apologize for being late. I won't waste your time making excuses. But I apologize. Hello.
I sent everybody an email yesterday that contained really two pieces of information. One was the key concepts on the Oregon safety model, because I thought given the way the this work group's charge was written, it was to get everybody up to speed on really how we're supposed to be implementing our practice in the field. And it does address several of the things that Michael and Megan addressed in their presentation. So that, I think we have the right model in place. We're currently in the process of, we're calling it an Oregon Safety Model Refresh, where we're currently in the process of training again, sort of buttressing the training of our management staff in the field around the key concepts of the Oregon safety model, and then providing them coaching opportunities as they transfer that knowledge to their workers on a day-to-day basis with live cases. And we're hoping that that will sort of strengthen our application of the model in the field. The other document that was included in that email was, I think it's called, let me find it, I brought it. It's what reports we can produce from our data. And it references ROM, which is results-oriented management, and it's a computer-based computer-based access for people outside the department to see the reports and be able to pull them themselves in real time. It hasn't been implemented yet, so we continue to need you to go through us to get the information contained in these reports. But I believe next year, in the first quarter of the 2014, we anticipate that going live so that people can actually go in and see for themselves where we are in each of these areas. But it's 2 pages worth of data that we can pull to inform the conversation as we move forward in this. I didn't pull all of them because we probably won't need all of them. But you can see that we do have data that gives us an indication of how we're doing in terms of reunification from the point of entry to the point where the child either returns home or moves to the alternate plan. And as I said, as we move through this, I can bring whatever information the work group feels will be helpful in addressing the things that we're supposed to address. We have an initiative underway right now called Permanency Roundtables, which are intensive staffings for children who have been in care 2 years or longer. And we're starting with children who were, as Michael and Megan said, sort of the low-hanging fruit. We're starting with children that have a plan, children whose rights have been, parents' rights have been terminated, and they have a plan of adoption or guardianship, but they're still sitting in care. And our effort is to see why are they sitting in care and what do we need to do to move them on. We know a number of these children either have extraordinary special needs or they're living with relatives. And there hasn't been sufficient conversation perhaps with the relative around permanency for the child and what that could mean. Even though they're living with family, permanency continues to be a need children have and to get the department and really the rest of the system out of the family's life. What we found when we pulled the data on these children, we anticipated it would be a number of children on APLA plans, older youth in the system, and that those children are there. However, there's quite a few children who are under the age of 6. And so as they said, there's an urgency for all children, but certainly an urgency for children who are very young to move them through the system. So we're hoping that those roundtables will help us do that. We're also continuing to implement Senate Bill 964, which is the Strengthening, Preserving, and Reunifying Families legislation. And that is really pushing out into the communities a broader service array in hopes of better meeting the needs of parents when their children have come into care or into contact with the department. We'll be done with the implementation in May of 2014 is our goal. And our hope, again, is that a broader service array is going to assist parents in being more successful in a timely way. Right now, just one number I'll give you. Of the children, our foster care population continues to drop, not precipitously, but we are seeing reductions in the number of children in care. However, of the children who are in care, 50% are under the age of 6. So there's a large population of children in that age range that Megan referenced that really need to either not be removed, which is something we're looking at. Do we always need to remove at the level we do, or need to move quicker through the foster care system to whatever their permanency resolution will be? And they raised a number of issues around why those kids are there without naming those kids. But I think there's the whole way the system works honestly isn't designed or isn't implemented with the child's needs first and foremost. It is very much driven by adult needs. And our ability to kind of focus that back to where the statute says would serve these kids well, I believe. So I didn't bring a whole bunch of data for y'all to go through today, but I can. Whatever you desire, I'll produce to inform the conversation.
Okay. Any questions for Mona?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
I understand, Lois, that some of the material and reports that you provided to the federal government come with the caveat that they are inaccurate based upon the implementation of ORCIDs. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I can comment on that. Thank you. It is true that we've had a data issue for about 2 years in terms of the accuracy of our data from when we implemented our new SACWIS model, our new case management model. The inaccuracy at this point in our data is based on converted data, not data that is being put into the system. We have confidence in all the data that has come into the system since implementation in 2011, and we have more and more resolution of the converted data so that we believe ROM cannot go live until we have an accepted report by the federal government, and we believe that we are just that far away from having that, and that will be the indicator when the federal government receives our report and says it's accurate by their standard. That'll be the indicator that we're ready to go, and we believe we're almost there.
In the ROM reports, are they designed to be both specific to specific cases, so that if I, for example, I recently just asked for a list of all the kids that were currently in care in my county and their birthdays, and that turned out to be an awful thing to try to acquire. It seems like it ought to be very simple, but it was very difficult. And this, I'm getting a lot of statistical reports just generally from OJD, but just getting something like that, like how many, if I wanted to know how many kids were in relative placements in my county and who they were, I think it would be hard for somebody to produce that right now.
I believe that we can, and I'll say this with a caveat that I don't have my data person sitting with me, but I believe we can give you a report of the number of kids in your county. To the greater group, I certainly could not give information about who they were.
Right.
But we should be able to give a report of the number and the type of plans they're on, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking you can do, but it's harder to get the individual ones that way.
Yes.
Okay. Because that's what CASA really needs. They need the ability to know who's where. So,
on the cases in which they're appointed,
mm-hmm.
I believe they have the ability to know who's where on the cases in which they're appointed.
We do. In my county, to track more accurately, we periodically receive reports of what DHS does have available, and then we also receive a report from the court and mm-hmm. do a comparative. And it's interesting, the differences, but that's the closest way we know to be accurate.
How many kids are and who they are that are
exactly.
In.
That's something we'll probably get into, all these different reports and who's doing them and how they match up. Okay, shall we go with that segue into the Judicial Department?
Sure. I asked Connor and Christina to present for the court as well as the CRB.
Okay. Why don't you guys come on up?
My name is Christina Jagernoth. I'm the Assistant Director of the Citizen Review Board. Just very quickly, the Citizen Review Board is a program within the Oregon Judicial Department that conducts federally required periodic reviews of children in foster care. Our boards are made up of citizen volunteers who are appointed to the board by the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. Currently, we have 66 boards in 33 of Oregon's 36 counties, and currently have 286 active volunteers who serve on those boards. So I don't have a PowerPoint, but I did prepare a two-pager, I guess front and back of one page, of some data that we collect. It's the data on the front page is from July 1st, 2012 through June 30th, 2013. So it's one complete year of data. So within that time, we conducted 4,030 CRB reviews statewide. And we also reviewed 6,074 individual children. Now, if a child was reviewed twice by the CRB, we only count them once in that number. Our on average, our CRB reviews are about 35 minutes. Now, we also track demographic data for the children that we review. About 32% of the children that we reviewed during that time period were under 5, and about 24% between 5 and 9. And we also track race and ethnicity information. About 73% of the children were Caucasian, 15% Hispanic, 7% Native American, and the rest of the data is there in that table. We track the length of time in foster care at the time of the CRB review. It ends up being about a quarter of the children we reviewed during that time period were at the time of their CRB review had been in care 0 to 6 months. Now, most of that is 5 to 6 months because we don't review children until they've been in care about 6 months. Sometimes it's a little bit earlier than that. But so if they're in care 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, we're not reviewing them at that time. Another quarter, 6 months to a year and a half. Another quarter of the children, a year and a half to 3 years, they've been in care. And another quarter, they've been in care 3 years or more. Now, starting in May of 2012, we started collecting quite a bit more data. One of those pieces of data is involves the eligibility determination of the Indian Child Welfare Act. So for the children that we reviewed during that time period, about 5% were eligible for ICWA. 86% not eligible, and about 9% were pending. That, if there's a weakness to that data, it would be in the pending part of it. We had some disagreement among our staff about what exactly was meant by a case that's pending for the ICWA eligibility determination. You know, is it a case where, you know, maybe the parents haven't filled out all the required form, but there's some indication that ICWA might apply? Does that mean pending, or does it mean if, like, the parents haven't filled out all of the stuff that they need, and but there's no indication that ICWA would apply? You know, some people felt that in both cases it's still pending, and other people thought that it was pending in one and not in the other. So if there's a weakness, it's in the pending area, and we need to clean up that definition. One of the other things that we started tracking was whenever the CRB made a negative finding on any of its 10 findings that it makes during reviews. You can see that, I have them all here. I'm not going to go through all of them. But about 78 78%. There's a big difference there. 78 children. DHS did not make diligent efforts to place a child with a relative or a person who has a caregiver relationship. About 155 kids. DHS did not ensure that appropriate services were in place to safeguard the child's safety, health, and well-being. For 115 children reviewed during that time, DHS did not make reasonable or active efforts to provide services to make it possible for the child to safely return home. And then I'll skip down to finding number 8. In about 724, for about 724 children, that's about 12%, DHS was not in compliance with the case plan and court orders. So one of the strengths of this data is that it's really the only place where you can get a list of cases where an impartial body has determined that the state has not met its obligation to the child or the family in some way for whatever reason. The weakness of this data, I think, I haven't done a lot of research into if there's any trends for why these negative findings were made, but from doing reviews and from reading a lot of reports, I would guess that it's the frustrating stuff that isn't supposed to happen, given current policies, procedures, supervision, and oversight. But you know, in a large and complex system, it invariably does happen. So it would be the hard stuff to tackle. Any questions on that data before I go on?
I have a question. The negative findings data, can you break that down? I mean, could that be broken down by county?
Broken down by county. The children, the names of the children, the names of the cases, yeah.
Well, I don't think we need the names of the cases, but I just want to know, could you say
Definitely.
X percent of these find that, you know, of number 5 came from Lane County or
yeah.
wherever? Okay.
I don't know if this is a timely question, so somebody stop me. I'm curious if you keep track of what happens after a negative finding is made in terms of how quickly courts who receive these reports respond.
We don't currently track that, but that would be a great thing to track. Our hope is that, well, one of the things when there's a negative finding, our boards can recommend that a judge schedule a hearing. Hopefully that recommendation happens. If it doesn't happen, hopefully the judge sees the negative finding schedules that hearing on their own, but it would be a great thing to track.
Do you have any information around, maybe you may have just answered the question, whether or not the court ends up agreeing with the board when they do make one of these findings and we go into court?
We don't currently track that information, but it's something that we could start.
My experience with number 5 has been that the agency usually requests a court hearing immediately when they get that one because they're going to lose their funding, and so there's usually a real flurry around that one, and it happens really fast.
That's true.
I have a question and a comment.
Mm-hmm. At a certain point, DHS was requiring caseworkers to report to the central office every time the caseworker came away from either court or CRB with a negative reasonable efforts finding. Is that still the case?
I don't know if that's still the case, but I can check. Jerry Weybrandt would have that in his office, so I can find out.
And the second thing I have is a comment. which I think sort of informs all of our discussion. I frankly find the notion that there's only 35 children out of 6,074 for whom there is a finding by an impartial body that DHS hasn't done its job to keep them with their family or return them to their family. And I don't know whether that view is shared, but I didn't hear Lois saying they were that satisfied with the work they're doing to keep people with their families. So I'm this particular data point doesn't persuade me about the way this group ought to work on reunification issues.
I think that if I could just comment on your comment, that I think this is indicative of the system and how it works. We're, you know, at risk of offending someone. We're in agreement too often for that kind of discourse we need around when we do something as drastic as remove a child from the home.
And a finding that they made reasonable efforts doesn't necessarily mean that they achieved the goal. I mean, the agency can be working very hard to eliminate the need for removal and place with families and all that kind of stuff, but it still isn't happening.
And, true.
Yeah. So.
And I do want to clarify that the 35 children, the finding that's attached to is that DHS did not make reasonable efforts to prevent or eliminate the removal. It's actually 115 children, which is also a low percentage, where DHS has not made reasonable efforts to make it possible for the child to safely return home. So it's more than 35. And also 92 children, DHS has not made reasonable efforts to complete the steps necessary to finalize the permanent placement. So it's quite a bit more than 35, but granted, you know, 115 is only about 2% of the kids reviewed, and 92 is only about 1.5%. So it's about 3.5%. That DHS is not currently making reasonable efforts in the case.
But the initial entry into the system is the 35.
Yes.
Right.
Right. Right.
So we're working to make that to keep kids at home at a much higher rate than we currently do. And I think that was around that comment, 35 times 35 cases, which is way less than 1%. We weren't in agreement about that.
With regard to 6 and 7, I saw some stats that you did, and I don't know if I can't remember now if they were statewide or for me or what, but that were really interesting, that might be of interest to the group about who attends the CRBs. And I on the next page, you've got some stuff about relative placements and no relatives, but the breakdown I saw was much more specific in terms of, was the mother there, was the father there, was the mother's attorney there, was the father's attorney there, were the foster parents there, was the child there. And in our county, those were generated, it resulted in a real change in how we were connecting CRBs to get the kids there, because the kids weren't appearing at all, and now they're it's a regular practice that they are at CRB, so it changed things. And that those statistics were very interesting and might be of interest to this group.
I think those statistics came out of the JSEP reassessment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not something that the CRB tracks regularly currently.
Mm-hmm. So did you do that?
I have a question just for my own clarification, so forgive me if you've already explained this. So if children were only counted once, if they had a review period, a review twice within that year, and similar findings were made again, would that have not been included in this data?
That's a good question. You must be a data person. They would actually show up in this negative findings report. In the negative findings number. they wouldn't show up in that top children reviewed. Not very many children are reviewed twice by the CRB in the same year, so it ends up being a very small number. So it's not going to affect the percentages drastically, but you're right. The children reviewed number is going to be a little bit higher, what you would calculate the percentages out of for the negative findings.
Okay, thank you.
So just very quickly on the back, I won't go, I think I've taken up more than my share of the time, but we periodically, the CRB collects case-specific data for a limited time, just something somebody is interested in knowing, we will kind of take on that project. We've done it for meeting the educational needs of children in foster care, you know, tracking how many of the kids we review are enrolled in school, on track to graduate, or in the same school that they continued in the same school that they were in prior to removal. We've also done it with relative involvement and placements. So we have a history of kind of taking these very specific data projects on and producing results.
All right, well, my name is Connor Wall. I am the data analyst for juvenile court programs in the Oregon Judicial Department, and I am going to be talking about some of the court data that the Juvenile Court Improvement Program collects. I have a handout, and I'm not sure if that is about to be passed around with some information on our the reports that we run and also what the data have shown us over the years. And I'm going to also go through a few quick slides because there's a little more information than I could easily fit on a handout. We run quarterly and annual reports that include statewide and county level statistics that are all drawn off of our court records. At this point, they all come from the OGIN system. I'll talk a little bit later about the fact that we are transferring to a new e-court system, which is not currently part of our data reporting, but will be in the near future. The most basic thing that we do is we count petitions and court events. There's a list at the top of the handout, all the different events that we track, how many there are in each county and throughout the state in a given quarter, in a given year, and we can also run these reports for a month or for a sort of custom time period if we wanted to. But we look at how many dependency petitions are filed, how many shelter hearings, jurisdiction hearings, permanency hearings there are, and also how much time the court is actually giving to those matters. And we do the same thing with terminations of parental rights, how many petitions are filed, how many trials there are, how long those trials are taking. We also have six measures of timeliness, which I think are the most interesting in terms of our data and in terms of looking at how well the system is working. And those are the pieces that I'm really going to concentrate on here. We have data going back 10 years, back to 2003, on three measures, which is really quite good and rich data. We look at the time from when a dependency petition is filed to when the court rules on jurisdiction, either takes jurisdiction or dismisses the petition or finds it's not in jurisdiction. We also look at the time from a dependency petition to the first permanency hearing, to the first time that the court is looking at the permanency plan and deciding if it's something that should be continued, if we need to move to the concurrent plan. And that is supposed to, by statute, be happening within 14 months. And we also look at, I should say, have been looking at the time from the filing of a termination of parental rights petition to when it's resolved. And again, that's either by being dismissed or by the rights actually being terminated. We also have five newer timeliness measures that are all federal reporting standards, and we started these in quarter two of 2012, so we don't have the sort of rich data going back. But we have a slightly different measure of the time to the first permanency hearing, looking at all the hearings that are held in a given quarter and then looking back at how long it's been since the petition was originally filed. We've also started tracking the time between permanency hearings, which are supposed to be taking place every year, basically making sure that that is actually happening and looking at what the averages and medians are in different counties. We also have two other measures looking at TPR cases that are different from what we had previously been tracking. We look at the time from when a dependency petition is filed, so when the case starts, to when a TPR petition is filed, so how long is it taking the system to get to that point where they're actually moving towards a termination of the parent's rights. And then we also look at the time from when a dependency petition is filed to when the actual TPR petition has been resolved. And then we, our last new measure is one that essentially looks at the whole system. It's the time to the permanent placement. And we look at how long it takes from a petition being filed to a child being reunified with their parents to a child reaching guardianship and a child being placed in a finalized adoption. So these are the measures that we track. I'm going to run fairly quickly through what the data have shown us over the years. This is a graph of dependency petitions filed throughout the state of Oregon, and I should say again that we track these measures on a county basis as well, but I'm just going to present the statewide data here. We see that we had a little over 5,100 petitions filed in 2012. 2012 is the one year where we're missing a little bit of data because we started moving off of OGIN onto the e-court system. But the trend has generally been downward, especially if you look back to about 2005. There was a little jump in 2009 and 10, but we've been moving down since then. If you look at termination of if you look at termination of parental rights petitions, you see a fairly similar pattern, downward mostly since 2005, with a slight upturn in 2010 and 11. It follows a similar pattern, but the drop is considerably larger. Looking from 2005 to 2012, TPR petitions dropped 36% as opposed to 24% for dependency petitions. So part of this pattern is that it follows how many cases are actually being filed. And part of it is due to other factors. This is looking at timeliness, so how quickly a court takes jurisdiction in cases or rules on jurisdiction. When we started tracking this measure in 2003, only 60% of the cases were meeting the statutory timeline, which is 60 days. As you can see, within a couple of years, we were up to 75%. We've stayed at about the 75-80% since then. This is one of those things where there are a lot of reasons why a court might not get to jurisdiction within 60 days. So we see that as a somewhat difficult number to improve. And this includes cases that do have continuances for good cause. So even if a case is continued, if it doesn't have jurisdiction within 60 days, it would be on one of those lines at the bottom that don't meet the timeline. This is the time to the first permanency hearing, which is supposed to take place within 1 year of jurisdiction, and jurisdiction is within 60 days. So we look at whether they take place within 14 months or 425 days. As you can see, again, we started tracking in 2003. We were only at about 65%, and since we started tracking, it's crept up through the years, and it's been right around 90% over the past several years. This is the time from the filing of a termination of parental rights petition to its resolution. These numbers obviously don't look quite as good in terms of complying with the timeline. They have improved. We started at around 40%. They didn't improve quite as quickly. The past several years, we've been in the around 55% range. So there's been improvement, but it's only a little over half of cases that are actually getting resolved within 6 months, which is what the statute calls for. This is shorter-term data. This is quarterly. And these are our new measures in terms of times to permanent placement. Because this is fairly short-term and because we're looking at quarters as opposed to years, I wouldn't, you know, go crazy over the up and down trends, but this is more to show the level of the time to different permanency outcomes. The green line on the bottom is time to reunification, so we've been right around 800 days for children who are taken into care, how long it's been from the first dependency petition that was filed to the point where DHS is released, so where they're totally out of the case. So this isn't this is including time where a child is on a trial home placement. Guardianships, as you would guess, take a little bit longer. We've been around 900 to 1,000 days. And adoptions take the longest amount of time to reach. We've been between 1,300 and 1,400 days for most of the time that we've been tracking, which, again, only goes back to the second quarter of 2012. Just in terms of the strengths and weaknesses of the data that we collect, the reports that we're running currently only cover counties that are still on the OGIN system. We have 8 counties that have moved to the eCourt system. We're still working to get reports that would be comparable to run in the eCourt system, so that is taking us a bit of time. So our data now aren't quite as complete, and there are counties that aren't getting reports at this point. Going forward, the cases that start off in OGIN and then are then converted into Odyssey will be problematic in terms of tracking data. And I think we've touched on earlier these sort of issues when you jump from one system to another. But the new system that we have is going to allow us to have much better data going forward. So the cases that are now getting entered into eCourt will give us the ability to track better and to track somewhat more closely. So that's a quick summary of the data and the reports that JSIP provide. I can take a couple of quick questions.
I have a question, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
So on the number of termination petitions, is that counted per case number or per parent? Do you know? Because some counties keep one case number for a family. Some counties do different case numbers for different parents.
Right.
Or children.
That is the number of petitions. Whether they're, well, actually, I'll let Leola, probably, who's done this a little longer.
It's the parent-child relationship. So if it's a termination petition for Sally and she's the only child, it would count as two if it's Sally's mom and Sally's dad.
Okay.
If it's two kids and two parents, it's four.
Okay. And then on the dependency petitions filed statewide and the, there was the, let's see. So often there's more than one dependency petition filed in a case, so your statistics, when it's counting the timeline from the dependency petition to hearing, was that based on the first petition only?
So you're talking about, like, the time to a jurisdiction hearing?
Yeah.
That would be looking at from a given petition to when jurisdiction is taken on that petition.
So if there was a case that had a dependency petition when the child first came into care and then a year later another dependency petition was filed about a different...
It would be when the court would be taking jurisdiction
on
that petition. The one that we do looking at first is looking at the permanency outcomes. So if you have a situation where a child is reunified with his parents or reaches adoption, that we look back to the first dependency petition to avoid situations like what you're talking about where there might have been three or four that were filed along the way.
Thanks.
Can I ask a clarifying question,
yeah.
Leola?
I just want to make sure I understand. I have a case in an appellate case in Columbia County, 5 children, 2 parents, TPR, that counts as 10. And I have a similar case in Multnomah County, 1 petition, 2 parents, 5 children, that counts as 10 also, even
yes.
though, so somehow it changes from our system to yours.
Yes.
So it's apples and apples.
Correct.
Okay, great, thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Next on the list is Public Defense Services Commission. We have anybody here?
Yes, Nancy.
I do have information, and everyone has a handout. I don't know. I can speak from here, or I can go up front. Either one. And I don't know if there's a preference.
Well, one of the things we talked about is I don't know what works best for our tech people. Would you rather that she went up there? Doesn't matter.
I'll go up there. Nice to look at all of the work group members from a different perspective. I can see everyone's faces a little bit more clearly. And I presented a lot of information in this handout that you either have or will have very soon. And most of it, I would say, all of you already know. But I included it only because I want to highlight a few things about the request for data and why it's difficult from where I sit to present data. We have a juvenile appellate section at OPDS where we handle the majority of statewide appeals in the dependency arena. Some do get reverted out due to conflicts of interest. We have a better chance of collecting data on those cases. Trial court representation, of course, is overseen by the Public Defense Services Commission. The Office of Public Defense Services actually executes and monitors the contracts, and they are 2-year contract cycles. And our provider types are nonprofit public defenders, consortia, private law firms, and hourly attorneys. Because we have these 4 different provider types, collecting data is very difficult. The majority of cases are handled by consortia providers. Those providers may actually have an independent private practice that is separate and distinct from public defense work, and getting people to use a consistent case management system that work with other, you know, that are consistent with other providers is very difficult. It's a conversation we're having, but it's not a problem that we have solved yet. Only about 2.6% of our clients are represented by hourly attorneys. Those are typically conflict situations, but again, they arise because there's a conflict that's somewhat unexpected. No one else in the county can handle the case, and so we revert that out to someone on an hourly basis, again, making a challenge for collecting data. I wanted to mention our contract rates. The way that lawyers get paid is by court hearing, so it's by event type. When there is a lapse in time between court events, the provider does not get additional compensation. The PDSC has quality assurance efforts that tie into the way that we collect information about how the system is running from the public defense perspective. There are 2 different review types. There is a service delivery review where commission members, we have a 7-member commission with an 8th member, which is the Chief Justice, who serves as an ex officio non-voting member. The commission goes out to counties and takes an in-depth look at how the county is operating. And Judge Welch is one of our commission members and is on this work group as a representative of the commission, and she may well have other comments she wants to add. But when we go to counties, we ask questions about time to disposition, about representation, time to discovery, investigation, and we get information, but we cross-reference where we can with court data. But it's much of what we gather is anecdotal information. We also have peer reviews. Again, before we enter into a peer review, we collect as much data as we can through the court system usually. But again, we collect a lot of anecdotal information about the quality of representation in the county. Service delivery reviews are aimed at identifying whether or not we have the right mix of provider types in the county. Peer reviews are aimed at really looking at quality of representation. The review findings from both peer reviews and service delivery reviews indicate that we do have providers with high caseloads, over 100 cases easily per lawyer. And what I want to mention here is that under contract, a lawyer who represents a sibling group actually only gets credit for one child, not all five. By contract, the only time they get a credit for more than one child when they represent a sibling group is if there are children placed in different placements, and in that circumstance, the maximum credit they can get is for two children. So if you have a sibling set of five and they all have different placements, that lawyer is getting credit for two. So it is a problem contractually and one that we would like to resolve, but it's an expensive problem to fix. We costed it out before this biennium, and it was around $5 million. So we have some problems in the way that we contract in terms of how we compensate lawyers for the work that they do, because really each child should have an independent investigation into their circumstances with school placement, foster care placement, service providers, et cetera. And I also wanted to comment, because it isn't quite apples to apples when we compare data, because we're not going to get more than one credit for a sibling group, unless there's a conflict of interest, in which case multiple lawyers can be appointed to represent different children. When PDSC goes and does their reviews, we look at performance standards, and we look at whether or not providers are meeting the performance standards. We find that our providers often are diligent attorneys who struggle to meet those performance standards. We look at both the Oregon State Bar standards and the American Bar Association standards. When we have providers with high caseloads, it can be difficult for them to meet their professional obligations, and we hear that from them as well. Shelter hearings, we find that, and that we've already heard this from Michael Livingston, but oftentimes lawyers are not present at the initial shelter hearing, and that means that parents are actually sworn into the record and providing information to the court without a lawyer present. And we've already addressed that, and Judge Sullivan, I appreciated your comments about how that affects sometimes that time to disposition and the quality of representation that the court sees. And I wanted to highlight the fact that one of the performance standards is that the lawyer perform an independent investigation. And so the less time the lawyer has to get to know the client and to perform that independent investigation, the harder it is to get a really good set of information for the court at the time of disposition. We also find that in some jurisdictions, discovery is delayed. So we have jurisdictions where the lawyer is not actually receiving any written discovery until 30 days after the initial petition is filed. When we look to other states, we find that these are not uncommon problems. These tend to be problems across the country. The American Bar Association has actually really started emphasizing the importance of representation, strong representation for parents and children. They have several programs running to help improve the practice. We also look to Washington State. Our neighbors to the north have been able to implement a pilot program that has been very effective, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Many of you already know about this, and so forgive me, but I thought it was important that we're all working from the same basis of information. So we just heard a presentation from Joanne Moore, the director of the Washington Office of Public Defense, and they started a pilot in 1999, and the reasons that they did it were much like what we had: excessive caseloads, low pay, not enough time for lawyers to communicate with their clients, and frequent continuances and delays. The pilot started in 2000 to 2005, and it was expanded by 2007 to cover two-thirds of the state. The keys of the program are caseloads that do not exceed 80 cases per full-time attorney, and they have standards that are that are expected, and they actually, their Office of Public Defense does quarterly reviews with the lawyers who are handling these cases. So there has to be sufficient time for open, frequent client communication, and the lawyers are expected to encourage early engagement, enforce the referrals for services that are ordered by the court, and advocate for visitation. All of that, I say, with the exception that there are times when the client's desires aren't in line with those, and the lawyer has to be cognizant of the fact that there are times when a child or parent does not want those, does not want that type of advocacy. So timely investigation and preparation of cases is one of the standards, avoiding continuances whenever possible. And the other component they have is including social workers. They have social workers that work with their office who are available to the lawyers who are providing work in this case so that when DHS is not, or the Washington counterpart to DHS, is unable to come up with a service provider, they have social workers who can actually investigate additional resources and present to the court an alternative service plan. They have found that through these efforts, they are achieving better outcomes for children, families, and fiscal outcomes for the state. This slide demonstrates their data, which shows that reunification rates in non-pilot programs were actually increased, or were actually lower than in counties that have the program. So 40% reunification in OPD counties, where it had previously been a little over 30%, and very little change in the non-pilot counties. This is very difficult to see, but when you're talking about time to disposition, through this program, they were actually able to reduce the time to reunification by 1 month, and they were actually able to reduce the time to adoption by 1 year. So it's pretty significant achievement through increased performance of parent lawyers. These are more recent findings that demonstrate that their caseloads, their dependency caseloads have been going down, and actually about 25% of that reduction is attributable, according to the state of Washington, to this parent representation program. So for Oregon PDSC's next steps, we were actually given $2.4 million during this last legislative session to start our pilot program. So now that we have executed our statewide contracts, we'll be moving into development of our pilot program. We have sent a survey to our providers to try and collect a little more information about where we are, you know, updating our information on caseloads. The preliminary results that I have back indicate we're still well over 100 per lawyer, and in some instances, far, far higher. We are also looking into, in that survey, frequency of CRB hearings and who is participating in terms of lawyers, and frequency of review hearings, time to receipt of discovery, and whether or not the lawyer is present at the first shelter hearing. So it's a fairly simple survey, but because we have all these different provider types, it has to be a SurveyMonkey style survey, and we're still busy making sure that people send us the information. I had one more. And we are continuing our reviews, the service delivery and peer reviews, to try to collect information. We hope to strengthen our ability to present data, both through the new court system and comparing that with our data. That's the way that we do a lot of our auditing, is by using court data to make sure that what we receive from our providers is consistent with what the courts are seeing. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions anyone has?
Thank you.
Do you think the people from Washington would be willing to come down and talk to us directly?
I am certain that they would. They have been down twice already, once for our budget hearing and once for the Juvenile Law Training Academy last week. But they're really wonderful and have expressed a willingness to come and share information with us.
Madam Chair, I do have a question. Nancy, I read that study a while ago, and what I remember is that spending money up front and attorneys save the state money in foster care costs. Is that correct?
That is my understanding.
And it was quite a bit of money, too, was it not?
That was also my understanding, and largely as a result of the reduced dependency caseloads. They had far fewer cases in the system. because they were able to adequately address the case the first time around.
Thank you.
I did have a follow-up, if I may. Are you aware, in Washington State is, I think their DHS is DHHS, I think that's it, or DSHS. Are they represented in court hearings by the Attorney General's office or the DA?
I think that they are, but I don't know for certain, and I'm seeing a head nod from Angela Sherbo, too.
That's what I thought. Okay, thank you.
And I will mention, because I didn't, that for our program, in Washington, one of the distinctions is that their children tend to be appointed a guardian ad litem, so rather than an attorney. And so in Oregon, when we do our pilot, we'll actually be including both parent and child lawyers, not just parent lawyers. So.
Thank you. All right. Next, Oregon Department of Justice. Well, why don't we take a break? This might be a good time to take. Why don't we take a 15
we were all
break.
Hoping.
Yeah. Okay, we'll take a 15-minute break.
I guess we're taking a break.
and I believe we have the handout. You're on.
Thank you. So I did have a handout, and I apologize it wasn't emailed, but I have emailed it since, and there's a lot of wording, so obviously I have a problem with brevity, but I wanted to make sure that you could at least just look it over at your own pace, and what I thought would do is hit the highlights a little bit. So I, like Nancy, I don't want to insult if you guys already know a lot of information that I'm going to say, but I wanted to kind of break down a little bit when DOJ is involved in the juvenile cases as a refresher, because I think we at DOJ sometimes run into this from judges, from CASAs, from DHS sometimes, from other attorneys. They're not clear when an AAG will appear or not appear. So at the front end, as we like to say, of the cases, so up from the shelter through jurisdiction or disposition throughout the state, with one exception of Blaine County, the DDA appears representing the state alongside DHS and handles the cases with DHS through that jurisdictional phase for the most part. After disposition, an AAG is involved and appears in a case in court if that case is staffed, if it meets certain criteria and is staffed and approved for an AAG to attend. And that is a staffing between the local DHS branch and the AG's office. There are certain criteria that are mandatory that these cases be staffed, like if there's a contested hearing set. So due to the limitations that caseworkers have of not being able to practice law, that there are certain kinds of cases where it's, you know, essential that an AAG appear. There's cases where it's an issue that may or may not be raised that we can staff with the caseworker and give them some ideas and some kind of strategy going forward, and then ultimately are not requested that we attend that hearing. So there's also staffing when DHS is seeking to change the plan to something other than return to parent. Most often the AAG will appear if it's guardianship throughout. Once the plan has been, or a decision has been made to change, request a change of plan, guardianship, an AAG will appear on that case and carry forward that motion or petition. And with a termination case, the criteria for staffing that is slightly different, as it involves central office as well as the local DHS branch and an AAG, with the understanding that central office is the unit that will finalize that adoption and wants to make sure that the appropriate best interest considerations and adoptability concerns are being addressed, the local branch's position on the case, and if that's their intent to move forward to adoption, and then the AAG reviews to make sure it's a legally sufficient case to carry it forward. And usually in termination of parental rights cases, once the case has been approved that we will be seeking a change of plan to adoption, then the AAG will appear on that case in court from that point on for most hearings up and through the conclusion of the termination case. But that does result in the majority of cases being handled by a DHS caseworker who is unrepresented in court. And so for DOJ, that's a big issue, and I think it goes to what Nancy was talking about, that this whole system will work better if it's a kind of totality of the circumstances and how every player interacts, and if every player is adequately and appropriately represented, then cases should be able to move more quickly. You're not waiting for a parent to get an attorney at a shelter hearing. You're not waiting for DHS to get an attorney to come back to have a contested hearing. If everyone from the beginning was adequately and appropriately represented, then I believe that those timelines would move more quickly. So that's kind of the outset of where our position is for court appearances. That being said, you know, throughout the legislative history, there has been funding given to DHS to access attorneys through DOJ for legal reviews on cases. So there is an AAG that reviews every child in care's case for the most part at two points in time, at about 5 months in care and then about 11 months in care. And that's done at the branch with a file review and a staffing with the caseworker and supervisor. So there are other means in place to attempt to move cases along and to ensure advice. It's just not necessarily in the appearance realm which is where I think some of the disconnect is currently lying. And the other barrier, and like I said, these are not in an order of first to least. It's some things I was thinking about when I was kind of strategizing in other work groups I've been in and in talking with my attorneys, that so often I think a delay in these cases comes from just the lack of court availability. I mean, there's so many hearings requested and different kinds of hearings, and whether it's going to be contested or not, and the estimates that are given for contested hearings vary hugely. You know, it's, we often hear it's going to be a contested permanency hearing, I'm going to need a full day or half day, and then kind of no follow-up on the number of witnesses you actually intend to call, so why would it actually take that amount of time? And maybe some courts don't feel it's their role to challenge that it needs a full day or a half day or a certain number of hours. But in order to get that significant amount of docket time, it's extremely common to go out months to have that hearing time. And nothing can move forward on that case until that hearing occurs and the result comes from that hearing. So, you know, the strategies, obviously, to address that aren't easy, and it wasn't easy to fit within, you know, staying within the current budget issue that we have. But maybe this fits in with one of those things that Michael was talking about to consider for the future charge, to if there's some way to get either additional judicial resources for additional judges or to assist certain counties with the way they organize dockets to assist with borrowing judges or assignments of judges to cover certain kinds of juvenile matters as opposed to other matters, or using pro tems in a way creatively that haven't been used traditionally in that county. And then I think I just put some of my best guesses based on what I have seen and observed over the last 10 years or so as to the measurements. So kind of I've just listed out how you could possibly measure that. And I just think maybe the number of days between a request for a contested trial or hearing and then the actual date set, be interesting to kind of track that now and then track it if some changes were put into place as to additional judicial resources. And kind of tying into that too is the attorney availability. And again, it sounds, I mean, you've got defense attorneys or parents or children's attorneys with 100 plus cases and often doing some criminal work mixed in or other matters mixed in. And then you were looking at the court docket issues and other attorneys' availability. And sometimes, you know, you're out months. And I, just from my own anecdotal experience, I used to practice in a county doing termination work, and you know, I was new to that county, and I went in with my, you know, you're going to have a termination date within 6 months, and the judge said, oh, we don't do that here. We're usually about 8 or 9 months out from the filing of the petition. I was like, what? So I think people get used to it. You know, there's that certain camaraderie kind of the community, and this is, you know, we all have busy schedules, we're all very respectful of each other's busy schedules, and one juvenile case is not necessarily more important than another juvenile case, but it's really difficult to hold hearings when an attorney is in a different courtroom and can't make it over to this hearing, and sometimes the judges wait and sometimes they don't, and then you've got a party that's not represented, or you have four attorneys sitting in court waiting for another attorney to appear. And then there's no time for the hearing, and then it needs to get set over or starts late. And again, I think it's not an easy resolution, but if there was additional funding or this pilot that's already out there for parent and child representation, lowering those caseloads would hopefully make them more available. And if there was some additional court time, all of that would help lessen that pressure and shorten that road that sometimes stretches out for months. And the other big concern that we see perhaps a lot more than other people, because we are staffed, when we're staffing cases with our client DHS, we see one of the things that we look at on cases is the basis for jurisdiction, especially with the recent appellate case law making it so clear about what the court expects and the opportunity of actual notice to a parent versus, you know, that they have an opportunity to know legally what the barrier to return is and an appropriate amount of time to address those concerns. So we look at the basis for jurisdiction in those allegations. And, of course, majority of time, the AAG is not representing DHS at that stage. And the language of the allegations either can be just simply outdated because of new information. It could be legally insufficient, meaning it's just drafted poorly or was drafted appropriately but then kind of got bargained with some back-and-forth settlement negotiations and turns into something that doesn't allow a service to be rationally related to that allegation. Or it's not an appropriate allegation, meaning what we see a lot of times is that kind of if the parent agrees to do the service, let's dismiss that allegation and we'll go forward on these other simpler allegations. And I think with this recent case law, especially this year, the Court of Appeals has made it absolutely clear that even if a parent knows just because they've been told or signs an action agreement or attends a service, that that won't be, you won't, DHS would not be allowed to request a change of plan based on that barrier. So that's why this number of second petitions or amended petitions, depending on what county you're in, are skyrocketing and delaying permanency, because not only do you then have to, either the DA has to file the second or amended petition, or there has to be a special request for an AAG to assist with that, which is not the norm, and then has to get on the docket again. So now you're looking at that extension of docket time, and then you have to allow the parent an appropriate amount of time from the jurisdictional, or from the date of jurisdiction, to address those concerns before you have that permanency hearing, which then will be set out months and months past that date. So the solution perhaps for that piece, you know, may be doable a little easier than it's not just a funding issue, I think. I've kind of listed out that some ideas would be additional training for state's attorneys, children's and parents' attorneys, and judges regarding the legal sufficiency requirements for petition allegations and the need for their rational relationship and kind of the what constitutes risk of harm. Because you can have those allegations that say the parent is, you know, abusing a controlled substance, period, which unless that's tied into that risk of harm to that child, it's insufficient. And petitions are drafted differently across the state. And there's times where if it's a straight-up legally insufficient petition that DHS may not catch or may not feel comfortable as the only unrepresented party standing up and saying, I'm not okay accepting this. You know, why is the child's attorney not standing up and saying this is not appropriate? Or is there any responsibility for the judge to say, I can see what you want to agree to, but I don't think this is legally sufficient. So we, I think, have been looking at accessing some funds to put on a state's attorney training, again, that used to be done in the past, which would be a way to assist some of the DDAs on the front ends of these cases, get that knowledge. And then I think, you know, we've kind of addressed this on and off at Juvenile Law Training Academy CLEs and also Oregon State Bar Juvenile Law CLEs, but there may be something tied into, you know, I don't know, mandatory training or some kind of online training or something that can be done and accessed that would be a list of kind of, we've got one kind of an internal list of appropriate language kind of that you could look at and use. So maybe if there was something from the parent side or the child's attorney side to kind of keep with them, so when a parent isn't willing to agree to an allegation, there's something that they can kind of look to and be creative about a way to phrase it that still gets you that allegation that you need and allows you to have that connection to that service. If they're willing to do the service, that's a huge part, so that's, you know, should be a way to get you to that point. And I think part of the issue with that dependency language is when you have a DDA up front in a county that has a criminal docket, a huge caseload, is, you know, trying to move through their caseload and everyone's willing to settle and get this done and off their docket. and the court is saying, I don't have much docket time. We've got five trials set today. Which one's really going? It's a very easy temptation, I think, to just say, okay, I'm done. Because once that DDA signs off, they're out of that case and not back into it again. They don't see necessarily the repercussions, with the exception of Multnomah County. They don't see, I think, the repercussions of some of their agreements or stipulations. And it varies greatly from DA's office to DA's office. So there are some that are very dedicated and that will look at appellate case law and try to stay on top. There are some counties where there's just no time, no people. They rotate through. It's often we find a kind of breeding ground. You've got a brand new DDA. We'll put them at juvenile for a few months, and then we'll move them. And we see that often, that there's kind of a rotation. And, you know, I mean, that's fair that happens, but is there a way that we can catch them when they come in with a solid training material or resources that they can access? We have at DOJ started a juvenile dependency prosecutor listserv, so we have a posting. We do kind of appellate updates as the parents and child attorneys do, and then a way that people can, you know, a DDA in Baker County can shoot out a question like, wow, I've got this issue I've never seen before, and then have the availability of all the AAGs and all the other DDAs that have been doing this for years and years, and be able to shoot back ideas and hopefully help them kind of gain that knowledge they need. And I think one of the other frustrations that we see with delaying cases is often the timeline the case takes winding through the appellate courts. You know, with the right to appeal on these cases, especially termination cases that are heard de novo, standard of review, that it takes, even though they are expedited, and the Court of Appeals is very clear that they expedite these cases, and I think that's completely accurate, seeing as the timelines that it takes civil cases to wind through the system. But the even that expedited timeline, when you translate that to months and months that child is sitting in foster care waiting, doesn't equal. It may be reasonable from a legal, academic perspective, but when you translate that into reasonable time for a child, it starts to not equal out. And so it may be worth looking at some options around that. And, of course, there is a new Court of Appeals panel coming in, an additional three judges. I'm not sure how much that will alleviate caseloads, but, I mean, it will help, obviously. It would be interesting to track if it does. Or maybe there's other options to allowing de novo review at request of the parties on termination cases instead of an automatic. I have to look again, and it's been a while, but I think it's not the norm state countrywide to have that de novo review. I think it's a special treatment in Oregon. So it would be something to look at those states that don't have it. Has it harmed the cases? Has it, are parents' rights harmed by that or affected by that in a negative way that we could maybe address in a different way on the appellate side? So I think that's all I just wanted to hit on, unless anyone has questions for me.
I appreciate the format you used here. I think you kind of jumped ahead of some of the rest of us. All right. That was good. Any questions or anything? Okay, let's go to juvenile rights and justice.
Well, being an individual provider of public defense, we don't keep data that's system-wide or county-wide data. We keep a lot of private, confidential attorney-client data. And so I'd actually notified Bill that I was pretty much going to rest on what Nancy had to say. It's the sort of system issue in terms of the perspective of people on the front lines for both children and parents. Let's say a couple of things. In terms of, I did take a look, and I do as a matter of practice and as a matter of supervision at our attorney's caseloads, and I spent a lot of time trying to balance them. And the Washington Project that Nancy spoke about, when she gave the figure 80 cases per attorney, and since those are parent cases, that's 80 people. But in fact, when Joanne Moore presented at the Attorney Academy last week, she said, we count the dependency case and the termination case as two different cases, because, as those of you who practice this know, your dependency case remains open, TPR petition is filed, comes back regardless. There's going to be some stuff. So that what she said was 60. Mm-hmm. 60 cases, meaning 60 people. I went to our single attorney, very experienced, excellent attorney in our office, the only person who only does dependency cases. Everybody else does a mix of dependency and delinquency cases. She had 124 open cases, of which probably two-thirds are children cases, and men in our county, children are joined in the same petition. So that's conservatively 140 cases by the manner in which Washington counts cases. In terms of the number of individual people, ages 0 to 50 or 60, to whom she owes every professional duty that any other lawyer in the state owes to a client, there's probably 120 people at any one time. Her calendar is impossible. Impossible. And the toll that takes individually, I'm not suggesting this person in particular, but the toll that takes on all of us who do that every day, all of you, all of us, is really substantial. And I think it has effects on the quality, although I think we, particularly those here at this table, hold ourselves to a very high level of what's quality work. So I have participated in these things for a long time. This is not my first work group on any of these subjects. And I will say right up front that I have a relatively simple solution, but it is not a cost-neutral solution. I don't believe that the kind of quality timely decisions, accurate, correct, nuanced, compassionate, just decisions can be made in these kind of cases, and I don't think you can change a statute to create those kind of decisions. You need enough judicial time, enough attorney time for all the sides, because you need all of the information, you need it accurately and timely presented, and you need the trier of fact to have enough time to absorb that and make the right decision as quickly as possible. So that's my bottom line. I'll just come out at the very get-go with my bottom line. And then I think that's really all I have. I mean, I think that the complexity of these cases, everyone knows. It's possible that that some of the non-lawyers may not know just how complicated and how many federal laws impact what we're doing. International treaties impact. I was telling somebody, I just had an email while I was sitting here from a lawyer in a courtroom asking the rest of us, can you answer this Hague Convention question for me? The judge wants to know the answer. So it's very complicated. We need the time and attention. There's nobody in this state, in my opinion, who needs it more, no litigants who need it more than children and their families. Thank you.
Do you know if anybody actually, I know Klamath Falls, their PD consortium has an investigator that's dedicated to juvenile, but I haven't heard of anybody that actually has a social worker.
We do.
You do?
We do. And we've made a choice, which is depressed our salaries.
Mm-hmm.
We've made a choice to have both an in-house investigator,
mm-hmm.
And we have, at this point, we have a single social worker, but we have also had, we also usually have since we have a social worker who can supervise, because you can't supervise a social work intern without a MSW, we usually have an intern from PSU at the same time, and I think it's invaluable.
Do you know if anybody else does?
I think Nancy's saying she does.
Klamath Falls actually is working with social workers.
Mm-hmm.
They
yeah.
have, I think, four
really,
that is available to their consortia group.
Mm-hmm. They're really innovative on that, and we might really want to look at what they've been doing,
mm-hmm.
because that's a small, rural core, and they still manage to do it somehow. So.
And we don't ask our social worker to substitute mm-hmm. for that which the attorney needs to do, which is develop the attorney-client relationship, see the client, have that confidential communication. But we particularly use our social worker with parent clients who the attorney has a relationship with, but there are so many service needs and maneuvering the complicated service providers, and she's been fantastic for that. I think it's really a great point.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Next, we have District Attorneys Association.
I do have a very brief handout that I did not get a chance to email. It's one page. I'm a trial lawyer. I do everything in outline form, including much to my husband's chagrin, my grocery shopping list. So it's very brief. And one of the nice things I think about coming at the bottom of, towards the bottom of the agenda is a lot of this has been covered. I don't want to spend a lot of time reinventing the wheel. I am here on behalf of the District Attorneys Association. I come from Multnomah County. This is by and large a Multnomah County perspective. It's certainly my intent as we move forward to reach out to the other counties and the other DAs and get a better idea of their experiences and their challenges. So this is really more of a Multnomah County focus, just by way of example of the challenges we are facing, and I think they're probably very similar in a lot of aspects to challenges that other counties are facing. We are in the unique position of Multnomah County. Not only do we do the upfront dependency work, we do all the terminations in Multnomah County from the district attorney's office. So we are the only county that does that. So one of my advantages to that, supervising that staff, is I, like most district attorney's offices, get some very young lawyers that get sent to me to do delinquencies and dependencies. We have the advantage of our very experienced TPR deputies that can do a lot of training and a lot of work with our upfront lawyers. So I think that changes the, I think that changes what our upfront lawyers know and their experience level and their training that I think a lot of DA's offices don't have the opportunity to do. Just running through this, we got some statistics. Those are not from OGIN. Those are from our internal system. One of my frustrations in my graph, my first attempt at graphing, by the way, at least on a computer, one of my frustrations is in Multnomah County, we have an initial shelter hearing, and then 35 days later, approximately 35 days later, the case is set for a pretrial conference and a judicial settlement conference. Parents are summoned to appear. The parties come in to see if we can resolve it. If we can't resolve it, then we should be setting trial dates. What often happens at that day 35 settlement conference is lawyers come in requesting another settlement conference. And so one of the statistics, just by way of example, I wanted to show from my office is, for example, in 2012, there were 418 dependency petitions filed, but our office attended 854 settlement conferences on those 418 petitions. And there are a lot of reasons for that, and some of them aren't as obvious. A lot of them is up front you have a mom, you've got three dads you're trying to find, and every time you find a dad, you're setting another settlement conference trying to resolve that other parent's case. So I don't think the numbers are quite as startling as they first look, but it all results in delay. And I think that's one of the reasons I just wanted to highlight those statistics is because that really lengthens the time both from the initial disposition of a case and then ultimately from a permanency hearing or a TPR if it goes that direction. You know, the longer it takes up front, the longer it's going to take to get through the rest of the case. There are a lot of barriers and a lot of these have already been mentioned. The parents' attorney's inability to meet with their clients prior to a settlement conference. That can be as simple as not being able to get their client in for a meeting, or they can get their client in for the meeting, but at the time that client comes in to meet with them, they don't have, that attorney doesn't have what they need from DHS. They don't have the documents from DHS about this person's failed drug treatment, how they've been doing, and whatever services, if any, they've done. And if they don't have sufficient factual basis, but at the time that they meet with their lawyer, then they're not going to have a substantive conversation. Now, in Multnomah County, DHS provides their court reports to the parties and the judge three judicial days before a hearing. That doesn't give an attorney a lot of time. And, you know, part of it is the attorneys aren't calling the caseworkers saying, tell me what you know. So there are a lot of reasons why attorneys can't have substantive or significant substantive discussions. And again, 35 days goes by really, really quick in the life of everybody in these cases. Sometimes it's not getting information from our office quickly. We're responsible in our county for ordering police reports, criminal convictions. If they're local, it's a breeze. If you've got parents that have criminal history in Spokane, Washington, and Sacramento, California, it's going to take my staff a lot longer to get that information. So those are some of the barriers. Our office amends dependency petitions. We meet with DHS 14 days after the shelter hearing. We call it a child planning conference. DHS comes in to meet with us. We look at the petition. Is this legally sufficient? Do you have evidence to support this petition? Are there other things we know and we need to amend the petition? When the system works and they come in at day 14 and we're able to have that substantive discussion with DHS and amend petitions if need be, that works great. Oftentimes, workers, through no fault of their own, will have to reschedule those. We give them an arbitrary date. But I'll have a worker call me and say, I just got an immediate response. I've got to go deal with five kids. I can't meet you at 3 o'clock today. So that sometimes causes delay just on workload issues. Getting absent parent searches conducted quickly. You know, finding these absent parents is just such a struggle for the workers. And I think they're mostly very diligent about it. But it creates delay. I've got a case right now where we found a dad, great work, in Mexico, and the consulate is telling me to set my next hearing in 6 months to have time to get the documents translated and get him served and just get the return of service that we need. So those are some of the barriers. There's judicial docket time problems. You know, you start a permanency hearing, you don't finish it. You might get on that judge's docket a month later if you're lucky. You know, you do a two-day dependency case, you don't have enough docket time to finish it. You know, we've had cases that take 4 or 5 months, once we've started a trial, just to find enough docket time to finish the trial down the road. So that's an issue. Attorneys' availability for court hearings is a huge issue. You know, we have a limited number of practitioners, and as Angela says, they're incredibly busy. You go to a court hearing and want to schedule something in 2 weeks. One, you're lucky if the judge has time, and then good luck that all three lawyers or four lawyers sitting around the table also have that hour available. So those are really a lot of the barriers that we face. Parents facing criminal charges in Multnomah County, it takes 4 to 5 months to resolve a criminal charge. If you're lucky, that delays a lot of dependency. You know, if you've got a dad facing a delivery charge and he's in custody, if you're waiting 4 or 5 months for that to get resolved to try and deal with your dependency case, that creates a delay as well. So these are just the experiences we've had in Multnomah County. Certainly, as I said, moving forward, I can get what I need from all the other DAs and other counties in terms of practice ideas, process ideas. Similar to Angela, I don't know that the individual DA's offices are going to be really good with a lot of statistics, but I think that's just a function of everyone has a different system and keeps tracks of things if they do in different ways. Questions?
I think I do have a question. So you have, because I don't think settlement conferences happen statewide, is that? So you have this system of settlement conferences that add meeting times to everybody's schedule. Mm-hmm. And are they actually to save judicial time?
Well, yeah, because when we go in for a settlement conference, so what we have in Multnomah County is you have a pretrial, so at 10 o'clock, all the lawyers and parties show up. You sit out in these little alcoves we have and talk about, can we settle? What are the issues? What language will people resolve? And then if we can settle a case, we walk into court at 10:30 and settle it right then and there and do the disposition. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of times what will happen is one parent will settle, but then another parent needs a set over. So you haven't perfected your jurisdiction because you haven't. But I think we can resolve up front a fair amount of cases by having that system in place.
We have automatic settlement, too. And what we do to avoid, I was interested in how you do your docketing, because at the shelter care, we set all our times right there so that we try to stay within guidelines by doing that. So we set, at the end of the shelter care, we set settlement, and we usually do that a day or two before admit, deny, and disposition if they admit. And then we set a trial date if we need it. So we've got all our dates when they walk out of the room on the first time. But we use settlements are considered a court appearance. They're not.
Okay.
They're mandatory.
Okay. And is there any ability on the judge's part to, let's say you almost finished but not finished your hearing, is there any ability on the judge's part to knock other cases that haven't started yet in order to finish those that have begun? So how do you end up months off?
It depends on the practice. The you know, and what your the problem, we used to, you know, I tell people years ago, I used to be in court at 10 o'clock at night, you know, and now because of the resources and not being able to pay the overtime, that's the only time we ever do that, and it's even rare for that is if we've got a jury out. Mm-hmm. And so we can't keep going past 5 o'clock and do that and like we used to keep going. But it's a real problem because every shelter care is not scheduled.
Right.
And so if your dog is tight, then often you have to stop other proceedings to do those. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get done, then everybody else is waiting. And in some places, they don't have, you could have Plan B judges and everything. They don't have the courtrooms.
So is there a priority? No priority set.
No, our dockets are set in Multnomah County that if you have a settlement conference from 10:30 to 11:15, that judge has something else usually starting at 11:15. Now, if courts run over, they run over. People have to wait to get into the next hearing. That'll certainly happen. But there's very finite docket times.
And it's individualized what they're going to dump. I prioritize these. The only thing that might bump a juvenile case for me would be an in-custody criminal where it was absolutely imperative and we had to dump. But it's different all over the place. And so the criminal docket's the big one that usually does it, but there's all kinds of things too. And if you, you know, you bump a contentious civil family law case for one of these, it may come right back around for one of these. So it's always a juggling act of what you're going to bump.
Ours is a little bit different because we, the juvenile court judge in Lane, just has that. And but sometimes you're having to do multiple half days or part of a day to fit things in. We don't have the settlement conferences, and with the time slots that are available, that would be an interesting thing to try to fit in. But we do set the fact-finding hearing at the shelter hearing where we have attorneys appointed for everybody. Child always gets one. And then if parents appear, they get one there. And they've already, most everybody's chatted before they ever come in for their hearing. So, you know, the discovery obligations are there, and there's people involved to make sure that happens. And if people aren't available at 60 days, we work our way back. And sometimes it's really quick. If we have to continue hearings, I find that suggesting Friday afternoon helps things to move along.
Open the show.
We have the joke about the who gets the December 24th setting. It's the case that the judge dislikes the most.
All right. Thank you.
And then we're back to where we started with CASA.
With CASA, I'm not going to hand out any more paper, and Lene can chime in here. But there are 28 CASA programs representing all 36 counties in Oregon, and they all look very different. So probably just as every branch looks different, every courtroom looks different, every attorney group may look different, so does the CASA programs. And you could have a... for example, the CASA program in Grant Harney County has a 0.5 FTE. So they have but of course they have a smaller number of kids in care. But you can also have most of the money for CASA has to be raised privately, and so it's really based on how well you can obtain community support in order to have enough staff to help support. Recruit, train, and support the CASA volunteers. So I think you do see, CASAs maybe look like they're trained differently. They and they do follow the pleasure of the court. So depending on who you have at the bench, your CASA, for example, my CASA program looks much different when we had Judge Henry and now Judge Love on than when Judge Leonard was on. So the way it works is different. Our reforms are different. Our court reports are different. So there's no consistency across CASA programs in terms of what a court report may look like. There's little tweaks to the training. So there is a national CASA training that we all have to provide 40 hours of training on certain subjects to our CASA volunteers. But then you have to add in those special tweaks that represent how things play out in your own county. So some things may look different. And then in terms of data collection, we have the same problem that you all do. So National CASA does have a database that they've had forever. And if you had time, I can imagine if you were a 0.5 FTE, the only part-time staff person in your office, entering data would be the last thing that you would be doing. So there is, although we are required by National CASA to report annually on lots of different things, such as lots of things about the demographics of your volunteers, the demographics of the children that you're serving, the demographics of the staff, when CASAs are getting appointed, how long it takes to close the case, what are the outcomes, the permanency outcomes for the kids that you're serving. So we do have to somehow, even on your 0.5 FTE, you got to come up with that information and be able to report it back to National CASAs. We feel on a statewide level that is an issue that we are trying to address through the Oregon CASA Network, and we are trying to find a data system because the national one is going to be no longer supported by National CASA, so all of us have to find a new data system. And so while all of us are out looking for a new data system, what we're hoping to do is find one that would work for everybody, that was manageable, you know, no matter what your FTE was, so that we were all reporting into the same data system and then able to report back out the information we need. So right now what happens if the legislative committee needs something, we're literally picking up the phone or sending emails out to individual CASA programs asking them to send us their data on, you know, how long your kids, you know, how long your CASAs have been on a case, or what's your retention rate of your CASA volunteers, those types of things. So there is no easy way for us to collect it either, although it is not impossible. So as we move through this work on this committee, if there are things that you want to know from CASA statewide, we have the ability to grab it. It just is harder to do. I don't know if you have anything that you want to...
The only thing that comes to mind immediately is, as I was looking at the CRB demographics and some of their statistics, they're really closely aligned with what Linn County has. I just finished a significant grant report filled with stats, and it's the children under particular ages is very closely aligned in regards to the percentages. The ethnicity, the male and female, we're hovering right around the same. Males 51, females 49. We're serving about 60% of the kids that are in Carolyn County. So I found that really interesting. This has been valuable information all morning for me. I've been with CASA for 17 years, 10 years in Jackson County, and now almost 4 years in Linn County. So I've worked in two different counties, and I've seen the varying practices. And it's interesting. And so I feel like I need to process all this through and see sort of where I come out in regards to taking that experience and applying what I've learned today from each of you. So thank you for being here. I want to say that it's important. And also from the perspective of someone who's been a CASA for 12 years and had cases for that long, what I believe that I can bring to this group is the faces of a lot of kids who've experienced lots of delays. And so what really brought us here and the bigger picture of trying to figure out what can each entity that's working on better for our kids do to create a better system as a whole. So I'm honored to be here.
Okay. Any questions or anything else on any of that? Okay, we've got three things that we need to do to set up for how we proceed. The first is, they're listed here, discuss a work plan and next meeting's agenda, review action items for next meeting, and then set a schedule for 2014. Our next meeting is set for Friday, December 6th. And I believe it's 8:30 to noon again. Is that right?
That's correct, Ben. Okay. You have not determined the location yet.
Right. And one thing we were talking about before we started today is that at least Leola and I are a lot more comfortable sitting in a table where we can sit around a table and see each other and talk. And so we're thinking that we'd like to move this, as long as we can record it, to a place that was more conducive to that. So we need to find a different place to meet, but Salem's fine. It's just a different room.
Leola, do you all have recording capacity? I mean, I can get a room at our office, I'll say probably, but I don't know that I have the recording capacity that would have to be brought in.
Yeah, what we normally do when we need to record and keep is use the conference telephone system recording feature, mm-hmm. and then they send you the audio clips of that. So we could do that. I checked the room in our building, and unfortunately it's not available on the 6th, but we can find another
room. Madam Chair, if we have to, we could use room 350 upstairs, or 343.
Okay.
The tables in 343 look like they came from a bingo parlor. 350 is nice.
Okay. So should we try for 350 up here?
Assuming it's available, but okay. we will convey that to you. Okay. Michael will.
All right. So let's try to do that. And then for 2014, how often do we want to meet, I guess? Does anybody have any feelings or thoughts on that? I guess one thing is, what is our end goal? Are we going to produce a report for the legislature? And if so, are we looking for which session and how long? And what is our legislative mandate? I can't remember.
January 15th.
Okay. So we need... Okay. So we're looking at the January 2015 session. We could stay on a scheduled meeting the first Friday monthly.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, in February, Michael and I have other plans.
Uh-huh.
The legislature will be in session for a short session, so it may be difficult for A, to find a room here, and B,
right.
we're going to have other duties that we'll have to attend to.
We could skip
February.
We'll have things we have to do during that
time. Isn't one of the questions whether they're going to be, it's going to be any kind of subgroups that mm-hmm. have assignments that maybe get their work done at an alternate time so things
right.
can move forward without necessarily having a
well
if we meeting, if we know. Set every 2 months and met in January, March like that, that would take February off and it would give other groups the alternatives to meet. So do you want to go to that type of a schedule? Is that agreeable to everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, and that would put our last meeting then in November, and hopefully we'd be ready to go. So, okay, so every first Friday, we'll meet in December, then in January, we'll meet in January, and then we'll go to every 2 months after that. Okay, and then...
can I just ask a quick question? Any way it's possible to meet the second Friday in March? Because I already know I am out, and
okay.
I would hate to miss a meeting, but okay. I will be out of state.
Okay, anybody have any might be better for the legislature if we go the second Friday. So let's go the second Friday.
Oh, there's a hand.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I have before me the list of legislative days January through December of next year. And I know you're talking about Fridays. The legislature will be here for legislative days on January 15th through the 17th, May 28th through May 30th, September 15th through September 17th, and December 8th through December 10th. So it would be difficult to meet over those particular days.
We would miss any of those if we went to the first Friday, and in March we'd be all right if we went to the second.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
May I make one suggestion, too? Mm-hmm. Could we consider the second Friday in January, which is the 10th?
Right.
Because January 3rd, it was right up against the holiday, and
worried
that that would...
It'd be hard for plane tickets and whatnot.
Yeah, and I would not be available on the 3rd. I didn't.
Well, do we want to go to the second Friday of every month?
Why not?
Will that bump us into any of those legislative days? I don't think it will.
Which days are on Fridays?
Yeah. Okay. So let's go to the second Friday of every month, and then every second month beginning in January. Okay. And then. I guess to start us off on using Michael's outline, the first thing that we're charged with doing is identifying impediments. And I noted that DOJ's outline and everything really follows that. These are the barriers. These are what I see. Do we want to have other groups kind of follow that same format that they did and move more specifically, or have we done that to everybody's satisfaction as to what the impediments are?
Well, I don't think we're done identifying impediments.
Yeah, that's kind of my feeling too.
Would it make sense to take the ASPA timeline and just start at the beginning and have conversation around where do any of us see, any delays or barriers, and just kind of start from the beginning and move forward through it?
Well, what I was thinking is I think that's a good way to pick up everything in the process and do the same thing that DOJ did, which is just simply identifying the main barriers and what resources you think need to be addressed to them. Each one of us in our areas, would that be a good plan? You're nodding yes because you already did it.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Well, our areas are not discrete, and some of us don't have one. Mm-hmm. And so,
well, except as a judge, you've been able to look at it kind of globally, so I think you could identify a lot of barriers that maybe other people don't even see because you can't see it globally. The other thing would be to break into some groups and have some group work on the impediment issues, and then again using Michael's format, we've got identify the impediments, identify specific actions that we can take, and then develop a plan to measure the effectiveness, and then go to some other things. So just taking those first two things. That's kind of what I'm working off of and what we ought to focus on for next meeting.
Madam Chair, lady, anything that the legislature produces always has a very complex history, and this list, the first item on the list is so clearly the main item on the list. Some of the stuff is very narrow and specific, and I just wonder if there are, for instance, just to give an example, assessment of the bases for dependency jurisdiction, is there someone in the group who thinks that that's an issue and that wants, in other words, to take some of these and see if people have this as sort of a pet maybe and could do a Joanne on that issue for the rest of us, because this stuff is... I mean, I agree with Angela. The issues, the ultimate issues are personnel.
Mm-hmm.
Or more hours in the day.
Yeah.
It might be cheaper to purchase more hours in the day.
Well, we've had a couple suggestions. One is to break it in each of these areas. The other is to break it by stages of the system. And the other is to break it by our disciplines. Any thoughts or feelings?
Actually, I would suggest perhaps a compromise to break it by these identified things and by the stages of the systems and proceedings for each of these identified,
yeah.
At least certainly timely resolution, that's going to start from the shelter hearing through the jurisdictional phase. I mean, I think looking at each of these would encompass the ASPA timelines.
So some of these, you know, when I read these, in terms of like C and D, the development and implementation of case plans that are appropriate and accessible and the adequacy of those plans seem to be kind of the same. But clearly, someone probably has a view of those case plans that's different than mine. Mm-hmm. So I would want a group to kind of look at that, and I'd want to be on the group to bring sort of the internal perspective from the department, but I need external perspective to help inform that piece.
So C and D seem to go together. Timeliness stands on its own.
Mm-hmm.
What about E? Is E part of C and D, or is E something different?
Yeah, it seems like there. This is an issue with mm-hmm. the adequacy of the department's
right.
Work. And so, aside from how the whole system as a whole works.
Okay. And I think on B, the way that's written there is a little different than we had it identified here. I think what has emerged from the case law, this is my feeling anyway, is some of the issues with the basis are, first of all, not getting them all in the first go around and having and the process for how you come back and pick up additional things is a hodgepodge. Everybody's doing it differently. In my county, they do it differently from day one to day two. They'll do it differently. Sometimes they amend. Sometimes they find another petition. Sometimes they file something called a subsequent petition. We've gone around and around about how to get those up. And then the other thing with the basis is the culture. I describe it as culture, and I have with my attorneys, is that these are not criminal cases where you go in and you negotiate, well, I'll plead to A and B if you drop C and D, and then turns out that the case plan is really focused on D and you don't have a jurisdictional basis and you get all these problems. And is seeing the basis for jurisdiction as the foundation for the case plan, and that they have to mesh and they have to stay together all the time. So that goes into the C, D, and E. So there's kind of, I don't know if everybody agrees with me, but I kind of see those as the two areas where that one is.
Madam Chairman, yeah. I was thinking that B meant whether the statute was adequate.
Yeah.
To start out with. In other words, whether the dependency provisions in the juvenile code adequately provide an adequate foundation for the process.
Does anybody know what the bill drafters?
I think that it was ensuring that all the allegations mm-hmm. are up front on the first petition.
And
as
the result might be that they need legislative changes to change the, so that's all part of it, I think. Okay. And then the F stands alone, I think, too, because that goes into a lot of access to resources, attorneys, all the things that we've been talking about that way. So what we could do is we could split. It would seem to me that we could put the timeliness, we could probably put
maybe get this into three groups, one that was A, one that was B through E, and if you want to put B in there, because C, D, and E definitely belong together. It's just, I'm kind of debating what to do with B and then F.
May I ask a question? The one thing, though, that I hope I'm not throwing a wrench into the plan, but the concept of reasonable time really has to get woven through the whole process. I find that when I really push on that question, kind of across the board, that's not something that's responded to. So then does that pretty critical issue start, you know, at the outset, and are caseworkers aware and planning? Are the conversations that they may be having with the DA's office? I mean, it's so I think part of that doesn't necessarily fit in, but the reasonable time component, again, and trying to make sure there's an appropriate focus on the child,
time,
I don't see how you can
everything.
Remove that from any of the stages. So that's just my concern.
I agree totally.
Why aren't really the issues of why isn't everything subsumed under A and F? And isn't this
really
just the case of drafters and lawyers who can't stand to have something very simple when they can have something very complicated? And aren't all the other things issues within? Let's get to, and I would make, not being a legislator, but I would say for ourselves as we consider this, that it's the timely and accurate resolution of, or the timely and something correct or quality, or it's not just getting something done fast, it's getting it done right.
Maybe there's the timely and quality resolution, or
high quality resolution. And A is sort of up to, maybe A is up to jurisdiction and F is thereafter, and that's really, if we, I don't know if we want to divide it that way.
Yeah, we could do that.
Or,
that makes a lot of sense, because then C, D, and E as being a part of that in the different places in the case is, yes, taken
well,
into
we
that.
Could do that. We could split into two work groups, one for up to jurisdiction and one after. That's short and simple. And then we can spread a lot of disciplines between those two groups. We've got
not to be a glutton for punishment, but can we set them at separate times so that those of us who maybe don't actually have a counterpart like Lois and maybe me can be at both?
Or
if we
can
choose.
Yeah, or we can stay together and not split into two groups for the next session, and let everybody. Do that, and let everybody do something similar to what. This handout is the one that's the DOJ response, but keeping in mind those things of what you want to look at. And that may guide us in then who should be working on what problems.
Okay.
So let's try to look at these A through F, and be real cognizant of the stages of the proceeding, which I think Michael is in his handout if anybody needs it. Okay, and so what we should have for before the next meeting is everybody should identify the main barriers, the main impediments or barriers, and what they see as areas that, not necessarily solutions yet, but areas that we want to explore more in addressing those barriers. So we're going to focus really hard on what the barriers are, and then we'll spend the rest of the year working on how we're going to address them. But focus this time will be to identify where the problems are and try to get, you know, if everybody gets their list, we should see where we've got duplication and really have a good work session and focus in on the areas then we want to work our report on. Does that sound good? Okay, anything else we need today?
So do we want to have these lists sent in advance of the meeting so that there perhaps could be some...
Let's try to have them by Thanksgiving, okay?
By when? I'm sorry.
Thanksgiving. Okay. Will that work? Because that would give us a week and a little bit. A week to get out. Will that work, do you think? No. We do it that fast?
That's right.
Madam Chair, you can route anything through us, and we will forward it to the group.
Great,
but I think you also have each other's
email
address. So, And you're talking about putting the agenda together for the next meeting, I take it? Sure.
Okay. All right.
I have a point of clarification and question. Sorry. Leola, were you suggesting that there be a template so that everyone's suggestions end up as part of the same document, or are you suggesting separate?
I'm suggesting that we submit our separate ones, and then we'll try to
combine them during the meeting.
In the meeting.
There's going to be similar stuff.
And I can work with Bill to try to get an agenda out, too. So we'll work on that. Anything else we need to do today? This has been really informative, I think, for everybody. And I would, one thing I wanted to point out in case people weren't aware of it was about Jelly. The juvenile court judges have a subgroup of the Juvenile Court Improvement Project, and they're working on, there's a lot of overlap with what we're talking about, with what that group is talking about. And at some point we may want to interface with that, particularly the group that's looking on juvenile code reform and legislation, and they are moving into that pretty rapidly. And so Judge Love and I are definitely in the middle of that anyway, so we can kind of keep you posted on that and at what point we may want to interface with them, particularly if they're moving into legislative areas around some of these issues. And then if we'd like to have the people come from Washington and actually make a presentation to us about that, we should probably decide when we'd like to do that and get that set up so we can think about that for next time too. But I think next time we're going to need the whole time for our own work session, so we'll plan to go. Okay. Anything else anybody needs? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.